You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for being here with us on this Thursday. I'm Rhonda McBride. The Black Awareness Association of Juno usually hosts on this day, but the group is taking a break to gear up for a second season of their show, Culture Rich Conversations, which often looks at the impact of racism from new perspectives. So I would think the topic for today's show is definitely one that they would embrace. We are observing Orange Shirt Day on Juno Afternoon, a movement that got started in Canada, sparked by Phyllis Webstad's story about her beloved orange shirt taken away from her when she arrived at a mission school in British Columbia. In a video, she reads from her book, Beyond the Orange Shirt, which tells the story of the shirt that launched a movement.
I'll read a section of the book on page 12. It's called Life During My Residential School Experience. I turned 6 in July 1973, the age for school. I was not unlike other children. I needed something new to wear for my first day of school. Gran and I went to town on the stage to buy something to go to school in. I chose a bright orange shirt with a shoelace string in front. It was bright and exciting, just like I felt to be going to school for the first time. If I was told what was to come, I don't recall. Even if I was told, it wouldn't have meant anything. All I knew was that I was now old enough to go to school, and that's what I wanted to do. I remember the morning that my cousin and I would wear our new clothes. We were jumping on the bed, excited to be going to school. We took the stage to the mission, about a two-hour ride. I can remember arriving at the mission, which would have been just directly behind me. The building was huge, unlike any building I'd ever seen before. I remember lots of crying and the feeling of terror. Pee your pants terror. When my clothing, including my new orange shirt, was taken, it didn't matter how much I protested or told them I wanted it back. They didn't listen. This was the beginning of that feeling that I didn't matter. We were made to take a shower. More terror. My baths were by the stove at Gran's. I'd never seen water coming out of the walls before. All of us little kids were terrified and crying. We each had our own bed, one in rows of beds. There was a washroom with lots of toilets and sinks.
That was Phyllis Webstad reading from her book, Beyond the Orange Shirt. Here in Juno this morning, you could hear the sounds of drumming and singing intermingled with traffic. Off the Egan Highway at the Wetlands turnoff, where people gathered hearing signs and waving at cars. Jamie Ann Hasselquist, who is vice president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 3, is one of the organizers of the rallies. And Jamie Ann, thank you for being here with us today. I was hoping maybe you could describe the scene for us this morning.
It was beautiful. I pulled up to the Imagine Hall Wetlands, and we saw a couple cars there. I said, oh, there's already two cars there. And then we pulled in. It's like, oh, my gosh, there's already like 5 cars here. And then more people just kept coming and coming. They were just stacked on top of each other. And it was a great turnout. We probably had like 75 people there.
Well, I see from Zoom, because that's how we're connecting on this program through Zoom, that you are dressed in orange. You look radiant. Was there lots of orange there today?
Yeah, there sure was. We had a big orange banner that was donated by Tlingit and Haida Essential Council, and a bunch of signs and people wearing the color orange. And we also had t-shirts on sale. So people were purchasing shirts, and I'd say that probably 60% of the people for sure were wearing the color orange.
So this is only one of two events. One is coming up later on this evening. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, we are going to be heading over to Douglas Island, and we are having a awareness rally at the pavilion at Sandy Beach, Anahia on the Gagne, where the sun rays hit first. So we'll begin at 5:30, and we have two MCs, Lance Twitchell and Lyle James. And we have other presenters, and we'll have some pop-up tents out there. We'll have some t-shirts for sale and start facilitating some more conversation and community healing.
So tell us a little bit about the t-shirts, because they have a very special design. They are orange, of course.
Yes, definitely. They are orange. They're bright orange, and they have a beautiful blue heart on it. And in the middle of the heart is a person with their mouth open. They are speaking their truths. They're having conversation. And this design is stemming from the children who were originally discovered in the mass grave with 215. And there's children now that was in Kamloops, BC. And the children who are attending Valley View Secondary School in Kamloops have started adding blue hearts to their shirts to represent themselves, the children, the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren of the survivors, so that they can tell their stories as well.
So who has put together these events? Is there a group of organizations involved?
Yeah, it started with me, and then I just snowballed into getting all of this beautiful support from all over the community. And I was a fight promoter for 20 years here in Juneau, so I kind of knew the ropes already and started reaching out to people. But Hatoosh Lashish has been just so wonderful and one of our sponsors. And then the Juneau Montessori School, Tlingit and Haida Central Council, Sea Alaska Incorporated, Gold Belt Incorporated, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska, Sacred Grounds Cafe. And I really apologize if I have missed anybody else.
I guess the message is that there are a lot of organizations and people involved in this, and that must make you happy.
It sure does. It's been wonderful. I didn't know what it was going to be like or how many people would really want to get involved. Ooh, I forgot the navigators of Tlingit and Haida. They're doing some things too. I haven't always had such a great response from my community, and to see all of these people come together for this community healing and conversation has just filled my heart so much. So Gunesh Cheesh, it would not be possible without you.
Well, we're going to let you go, Gunesh Cheesh, for being here with us on it must be an incredibly busy day for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, our conversation about Orange Shirt Day continues. Lyle James and Lance Twitchell do a lot of work trying to repair the damage that government institutions caused to the language and culture of this region. Some truth, reconciliation, and some healing when we come back.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Thank you for being here with us today on Juneau Afternoon, where we are observing Orange Shirt Day, a day of truth, a day of reconciliation, a day to re-examine the history of government institutions and their impact on Indigenous children. I'm Rhonda McBride, and here to help us open your hearts and open your minds as we travel back in time and also look ahead to the future, Hune Lance Twitchell and Ghitlish Lyle James. Gunesh Cheesh for being here with us, and also part of the conversation today, Rasha McChesney, a reporter here at KTOO, who has been covering today's Orange Shirt events and also doing some research into the history of the Mayflower School and other boarding schools, residential boarding schools. And it's so good to have all of you here. You know, it's sort of hard to know where to start. So perhaps, Lance, we'll begin with you. And where should we begin in talking about this subject?
Well, I think if I could pick a starting point, I'll just start in Tlingit and say something to the survivors of boarding schools and those who may not have survived. Atlin Kunchi Shui Yuhan, Yigwe Hwan. wasai tu ye tio ehlatsin hashik o hasaya yitutaya hasawa ti qashte khwasa hasaka aq hajitakh awasatli aya ya haqusti qaha yuqatangi atkh isati kakh atkh isati kalta sayakh kuke hayuqatangi atoy kakhtu aq Kaya ye gartu sene. Kaha yu katangi hatawasuku kegurtsini. Ye awa hayatki. Hasagur saku wasa atwune. Ajoe tatatwash good suka kwane. Gulchish. To those who are affected, to those who have gone through it, to those who never made it home, I would say thank you for going through that. For what you've endured. Unfortunately, many people brought home a lot of pain. They brought home, I think, many of the abuses that they sustained. So in Tlingit, they said, our ancestors, they put strength inside of you. And it doesn't matter how much people tried to take away our language and to take away our way of life. We're going to hope that it gains strength through our children. And we're going to make sure that our children know what kinds of things happened so that they can never happen again. But also as we look to restore and reclaim our indigenous languages and our ways of living and to try and be stronger, healthier people, we try to imitate our ancestors and try to put together a lot of the things that were taken from us. Through some of these places, it wasn't just places where indigenous children were sent. It was places right in our home communities. The things that teachers were able to get away with and religious leaders and government leaders across all the lines of inhumane, illegal, immoral, and horrible treatments that Marge Dutson, one of the elders I worked with a lot, said it was torture. They tortured us, and they tried to make us feel like we were always less than what we were. And we are noble people. We belong to this land. And some of the things that we stand against today are the echoes of the type of racism that allows people to do things like this and be pretty much unchecked and to not have enough people who stand up and say, how could you do that to children, to families, to people? So to everyone who has suffered, we extend our hand, we open our hearts, and we take a journey to a place where we say, it's a better world when we get rid of things like that, like racism, hatred, and leaving people out in the cold on their own land. Gunashchish.
Gunashchish. Lyle James, you spend a lot of time working with youth, trying to inject them with a love of their language and culture. What drives you to do that? Is it your own experience in your own family, perhaps, with this institutional racism?
Ya ishas khagontan yushkana khut ya ti ekashati yukhatangi ya idat eka yukhatangi it bahas takat akkan akengon chish ya nikal ya yushkana khut ya ti ya yekiyi To my grandparents who are Aquan, goodness chish, we are honored to be on your land. Because we know that this is history that is no more than two generations ago. And some are one generation ago. And some today have experienced it firsthand. This is something that doesn't just disappear. It's something that our students still face today. In the schools where they start placing students and teachers and staff in one location. That is an example of institutional racism, thinking that they place them in one corner or one room and they won't be a nuisance. Well, we are experiencing it today. These are things that have been around, as we said, for generations. My grandfather, my father's father, didn't talk about it until towards the end of his life. Talked about how the teachers, the first thing that they did when he stepped into that classroom, he asked one of his classmates, one of his friends, do you know what they're saying? Or do you know their words? And the first thing he felt was a metal yardstick on the back of his hand. And it wasn't the flat side of the ruler or that yardstick. It was always the edge. He held his hand up and he said, look, each one of these from a teacher who didn't like me, who got mad at me when they said, speak English. I didn't know what English was. All I know is that I always kept on getting trouble every time I spoke. These are things that we see and sometimes we get exhausted from. And we are here to say, we're not going to stand alone on this. We're going to ask our relatives to stand with us so that we can bring attention to something that should be known, is our relatives who didn't get to make it back home. They should be on their homelands. They should be identified and they should be addressed and they should be given back to their families.
Rasha, you wanted to ask a question?
I do. And I, Lau Gunashchish, for sharing those stories. You know, Rhonda mentioned earlier that I've been doing some research into Juneau's boarding school history. And I was really struck as I was looking at the Mayflower School on Douglas, which is a former BIA school, at the available information about that school. And specifically, there's this, you know, the application to put it on the National Register of Historic Places includes this really long narrative about how the school was used. And it very specifically says, you know, holds up the school as a community center and says the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood regularly met there, and says former students recall happy memories and the sense of community provided by that school. And it just seems like there's a real disconnect there. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that disconnect and that school specifically.
Yeah, Gunashchish. I feel like this is a symptom of American education and of Americans' portrayal of history. Is that we don't want to look at some of the things that happened. And sometimes it can feel a little innocent, like, oh, that's painful, or that's uncomfortable. But I think a lot of times it's awfully dehumanizing. Like if something really terrible happened, like if I did something really awful to you, and then I never even mentioned it. I just don't understand how we could still just talk and visit, you know, like if I burned your house down. And so when we talk to elders, I'm informed by a wonderful linguist. His name was Dr. Michael Krauss, who told me, you got to go document these stories firsthand from your elders and see if they'll tell you in your language, because there's going to come a time when no one's going to believe them, because no one has taught anybody these things. It's not talked about enough. And so I went to some of our elders, and the first first narrative that I probably encountered was Kyuchni Nora Dauenhauer talking about on a program here in Juneau where they're documenting history of this area through StoryCorps. And she said when she went there, they poured kerosene on her hair. They said it was going to kill the bugs or something like that. And how she just felt like, you know, that's day one. I get kids, they're 10, they're 8, they're 6. They're so blessed to be in the TCLL program surrounded by teachers who love the kids and love our culture and love our language. And then Marge Dutson told me her story, and I said, her name is Shekshani. She's Ishkitan. And I said, so she was the first one I asked. I said, would you talk to Nthlingit about what happened to you there? And she said, I'll give it some thought, and it's going to be hard. And one day she called me, she said, okay, I'll do it. So I set up all my equipment to record her. And the first thing she said was, Tl itu chul chishik, wasa ishan deen yuha kawa shu, chutle tl katua ashku ha yuha tangi. And then she moved into getting to the story, and when we were done recording, she turned to me, she says, do you remember the very first thing I said? And I said, it was something too difficult for me to understand, or it was possible or not possible, or something was in there. And she said it again. It's impossible for you to feel how much we suffered when people didn't want our language. She said, I had to start with that. That's how I had to start this story. And I sent it to lots of people who study Tlingit. I was like, do you guys know what this says? And nobody could get it. It was very high-level language, I think. But then she called me later and she says, you know, I didn't even get to what that teacher did to me when I recorded that story with you. I said, oh, I know. It's difficult. It's okay. It took her a second try to get to it. So imagine your child, 5 years old, first day of school. Her older siblings had said, you can't speak Tlingit there. You can't. Well, if you got a five-year-old, go ahead, send them somewhere for 7 hours. Tell them don't speak the language they know. It's not going to work. And it's also incredibly cruel and just wrong to try and prohibit an indigenous language on an indigenous land. So she went and she saw kids she knows and she's talking to them. She was 90, probably 92 when we recorded this. Everybody spoke Tlingit then, all the kids. And so the teacher calls her in front of the class because she was speaking Tlingit. She didn't know. This teacher, who she said was a very big person, she grabbed little Marge by the hair, lifted her up, clear off the ground, shook her violently, yelling, if you do this, I'm going to hit you right in the face. Don't speak that language here. And let her go. She went and got her stuff. Her hair was pulled on, just going every direction. She's crying. She's shocked. She's traumatized. She cries all the way home. She told her dad what happened. And her dad almost went and took out that teacher. What do you do? What do you do? Somebody does that to your child. And that's the person who's in charge. That's the person who's teaching. That's the environment that they knew. And I had lots of elders who told me lots of other stories. And it's not just us who document this stuff. These two teachers wrote this book. In the book, they bragged about it. They said, we had a hard time getting them to stop speaking their language. And that's what they said. We came up with this heroic remedy. We found these two chemicals, one that just burns real hot, the other one's just more bitter than anything. We mix them together and we soak a rag in there. We catch them speaking our language, we stuff that rag in their mouth. These are the things that people did to children that I don't think enough people talk about. And it goes way beyond that, way beyond the levels of physical abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse, psychological abuse, and sexual abuse of adults in charge of these children. And then you add to that you remove them from their home. How are families going to fill that absence? How are they going to fill that vacancy of their children leaving? By trying to just destroy themselves. And then they see the land being lost. The English language at this particular time, the 1920s, full of hatred for indigenous peoples. All the things they would call us, all the things they would say about us. And then that's the medium of communication that replaces our beautiful and irreplaceable Tlingit language. So when I see stuff like that as they sort of try and preserve the history, I usually think that's not the story. There are portions of a story there, but how are you not going to tell the whole story? It's like you're going to tell me the biography of somebody. And I was like, yeah, he sounds like a pretty cool guy. But then I find out that he's a mass murderer. I'm like, well, you can't leave that part out. You can't tell a story like that. So we're trying to look at these incomplete pieces with a lot of the work that we do, with bringing the language back to a safe place and helping people overcome the wide variety of traumas that are left in the absence of those children being taken and the people being punished.
Rene, you mentioned something earlier about, you know, if you burned my house down, you and I would have a really hard time having a conversation absent you maybe acknowledging that you burned my house down. And it sounds like acknowledgement of a shared history is a very important part of this conversation, because every time there's a lack of acknowledgement, those wounds get sort of torn open again, anew, because we just can't get to the point where we're saying, yes, these things happened. But it feels like the trauma is perpetuated for so long beyond the original event, beyond getting kerosene poured in your hair or being shaken. Your grandchildren and the great grandchildren know those stories. And I guess I just wonder if, while you're collecting those stories, if you see a direction to go in, what do you do once you find all of that trauma?
Yeah. Back to the house metaphor, as uncomfortable as that is. And it's not like I bumped a candle and it tipped over. I was up there with a tank of gas and a book of matches. And so looking, you know, there's some people who teach classes who say, like, there was no intention for these things to happen. It's not genocide because nobody meant for it to happen. And there's people who teach who talk like that. And I say there was absolutely intention. I was sitting at a hockey game one time, just trying to enjoy a hockey game, and this McDonald's commercial comes up, and it says, kill the hunger, save the man. Ruined my whole day. The person who invented these boarding schools for Native American people said, kill the Indian, save the man. And I think, is that a coincidence? Did they grab that from somewhere? But I think to start talking about a series of directions to move in, I think one is collecting these narratives and looking at them, making them part of our story. Because if this stuff happened to white people, we would talk about it. There would be statues, there would be memorials, there would be days set aside for these things. There would be so much. And because we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of children. So many of them never came home. But I think the next step is to say, well, who did this? State governments, federal governments, and religious institutions. And what are they doing now to ensure that these languages will live and will thrive and can come back to a place where some of that stuff, it should never have happened. It should never have happened that way. The indigenous peoples under that situation posed no harm to colonizers. And there was no right to come in and try and annihilate the languages. Such wonderful things. You can't remove a language and expect the people to just go on. They get lost. Then they have a hard time finding their way back because the identity is so mixed up and the language at times seems unattainable. So we try to show them, like, you can learn this language, no matter who you are, no matter where you're from. And then you can use it on this place, which is part of creating a different narrative than this big lie of manifest destiny that people sold themselves on, that this is what they're supposed to do. So I think collecting these narratives, analyzing them, instituting some actual healing ceremonies and opportunities, completely working towards reclaiming and restoring Indigenous languages by including them in state standards of education, having an Alaska Native language teacher in every school, and just say, hey, wherever you graduate from, you got to do a year of an Alaska Native language from that place, or from, you could pick another place if you're ancestrally Koyukon. You can learn Dinaka, and just to make this part of the landscape, because it always has been and it always will be.
Lyle, you want to add to that?
So many things that it is hard to talk about, even though it is so current. And one thing that I know that we quite often hear as Indigenous people from our lands is, well, it was in the past, get over it. And it's an annoying phrase, and it's like a cop-out for those that don't understand. And for them to say, oh, it happened in the past, just get over it, or I wasn't part of that era, so you can't blame me. Well, if you're not doing anything, you're part of the problem. If you're not saying something about it, you're part of the problem. When we start to vocalize and we start seeing this balance of equity in our community, and that our Indigenous people aren't seeing these injustices, then we'll start to see some equal ground. But that's a long ways from now.
One thing I do want to ask about the fire metaphor that you chose, Hune, there was a fire in Douglas, right? And it was set intentionally. What's the story of that? Because I think most people in Juneau have no idea about that chapter of history. It has literally been erased.
I think it's important to know these stories, to know that people burned down a Thlinget village and built the community of Douglas on top of it. I think we need to figure that stuff out. I think in Southeast Alaska, the United States Forest Service actively burned down Native homes and fish camps so they could claim it as unoccupied land. They would come up with these laws to talk about how something could be declared condemned or abandoned. And we have someone who's coming tonight who bore witness to that, to his own home being burned down, and to watch it, and then to see someone else, you know, build their homes on top of it. Some people probably have really nice houses. And there's other neighborhoods in the Juneau area where Indigenous peoples and Filipino families have been deliberately displaced by policy. And that's the thing, is we're talking about policy here. We're talking about what people collaborate and collectively decide to do. And we got to figure out, like, what do we do now? It's a complicated situation, but it cannot be left up to only the marginalized and oppressed to figure out for themselves. We've got to figure out, well, what now? And we also need to educate people. So if they're sitting there complaining about how their neighborhood is changing, perhaps, you know, someone once said the gentrification of the flats. And I said, oh, you're talking about right now? Because that's pretty gentle. And you should probably look at what happened there to Indigenous peoples and Filipino families. Because it's a part of our history. And even if you just moved here yesterday, you're going to live here, buy a house, rent a place, get a job. You're part of this. But that doesn't mean that you need to carry the burden by yourself, but it means we got to collaborate and figure out how to help people through some of this stuff, and to say, you know what? You wouldn't do that to your neighbor, would you? So why would that be allowed to happen to peoples? And to say people were targeted because of who they were. And who they were people of the land. The Akkwan, who are from here, they're on Yetkosani. That's as high as it gets. And to say sort of, do we see them? Do we acknowledge them? Can it go beyond a land acknowledgement and move towards a place where, say, we could actually collaborate and make life a lot better for everybody here by embracing some of these things, by rejecting racism, and by doing some of the work it takes to overcome the systemic structures that privilege some and discriminate against others. I've shopped in this town and not been able to buy stuff in stores. And not only that, but they could call my boss if I complain about it. That happened to me here. So we still live with these residual effects. I can hear people making fun of Native people by doing some kind of Native accent that they think is funny. And these types of things, they tend to reverberate for me in terms of echoes of this past, where we could say, we don't have to look at those things. And I think we should, because dehumanizing people that we live with is a very dangerous thing. And it really allows people to do inhumane acts against others, whether it's an individual level or collective groups making these decisions.
Well, there is that saying that all of us will only be free if all of us are free, something to that effect. And you know, thank you for telling us about what happened in Douglas. Lyle, we have talked a lot about kind of the past, telling the truth of the past, and a little bit about reconciliation. What about healing?
We have a long ways to go until folks take the time to understand the true history of what happened to our people and stop saying, oh, that's not my job. We're asking just a simple task of listening, taking the time to understand when for generations, we as Indigenous people have been always told, oh, you need to learn this history. This is the important history. Our history is just as important. And even more so for us, because our ancestors, our relatives actually lived it. When educators take this serious and stop pushing it to the side and thinking, oh, it's not written, so it's not real history. Well, when you have people telling their truth, and it's because they lived through it, it is history. For generations, our ancestors, that's how we passed our history down from one to the next.
Boy, I hate to say this, but we're going to have to wrap up our conversation. And boy, I think we'll have to come back and have more discussions about this. But one of the things that is very fascinating to me is, despite all the things that happened to these elders, there were quite a few of them who became culture bearers. I remember David Katsik telling me that he was punished for speaking Tlingit by being made to hold stones. And every time he spoke Tlingit, the stones would get heavier and he'd have to stand there longer. And he turned it into a game. And his mind went other places and he thought about other things. And so, Lance, I know you are putting together a screenplay. You got a Rasmussen grant to do that. Is it these stories of resilience that we should look to for inspiration?
I think it is, and I think it also helps us to see that a language is more than just another way to say things. So Selina Everson she was an incredible, beautiful human being who was also a survivor of boarding schools. And she was sharing things that she went through, and she is sharing the pain of not being able to speak the language that she knew best and that connected her to her ancestors and future generations. But at one point she said, Hausanecha yuchatangi. And I was sitting next to her and I thought, that's it. Our language healed us. Our language saved us. And then to hear the determination of of elders, like Willie Marks and his brother, who got brought out of state, far away to a place where they're supposed to be put into this boarding school. And when they saw how people were being treated, when they saw what happened, they got out of there and they made it all the way home as little kids. And to look at that and to see, I try to use this as inspiration for language learners to say, this can be difficult, but you think of everything that the people went through who lived here. You think of all the suffering and you think of all the strength that it took to maintain what they have and what they gave to us. You're going to use that same level of strength, that same level of determination to make sure it makes its way inside of you. It becomes a medium of communication and it becomes something that you hand off to other generations. And that restoration, it brings us to this place that we call Katuksakeyihin, the river that entangles a person's mind. Sometimes we call it the peaceful river. And Cyril George would talk to us about that. It's this place this boy went back to after he got turned into a salmon and he made it back to his family. And he would talk about how coming back to these places helps people become whole again, helps families remember that we have ways to raise our children. We have ways to live and to talk, and they're not evil and they're not less intelligent and they're not less capable. I see all these ways that people used to write about us and I just think, who are you? We didn't even get to know the people. They say, think of people, they don't love each other. It's like, get out of town. We love each other so much. And if you speak our language, you'll get that.
Gunashchish, I really appreciate the two of you being here with us, Lyle James and Lance Twitchell. And Rasha McChesney had to dash off on a deadline here, but she really appreciated talking with you as well. Gunashchish.
Gunashchish.